If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Wine's been in my blood a long time. My parents actually started me early, and I think today, if I were to say this and I was young, they might actually be accused of child abuse of some sort. But
that's so funny, because my vineyard manager over in Sonoma once told me that if I ran into a bear, I had to throw my arms in the air, and if I ran into a cougar, then I had to roll and play dead. And then I thought, well, isn't it supposed to be the other way? And he said, oh, yes. I said, well, you trying to kill me?
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 471. This week we feature Tom Gamble, owner of Gamble Family Vineyards in Napa Valley. Our last visit with Tom Gamble of Gamble Family Vineyards was back in September of 2016. That was podcast 199. And now we're back in the valley in person with Tom. Gamble Family Vineyards is hidden in plain sight just off of Highway 29 and well worth the find. I met up with Tom in early December to get caught up on the happenings at the winery, as well as looking back at the crazy year known as 2020. You can also hear Tom on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term Ambulo Blanc. It's great to be back in Napa Valley Live. We're here with real human beings talking instead of on a telephone. And we're here with Tom Gamble of Gamble Family Vineyards. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm doing great.
It's great to see you again. It's been a few years.
Yeah.
Since we had you on camera.
Yeah, it might be 3 or 4 years.
About that, yeah. But the place is still beautiful.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After all the mayhem of COVID, fires, plague, locust, whatever.
Well, it was pretty quiet around here, so not a lot of wear and tear on the hospitality salons here.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But you were talking about the wine dinner, and you were talking about people back and how good it feels. Is it weird for you? I mean, what is it?
No, it's not weird at all. Napa Valley isn't the worst place to isolate during the height of the pandemic, and it was very quiet. But there's a big complaint in Napa about traffic. And I think now people are probably grateful to have traffic, because that means that there are people enjoying wine and the great hospitality that happens throughout the valley. And we were doing a wine dinner at Bottega last night in Yountville, and the town was full of folks from wherever visiting and enjoying good food and good wine in each other's company. And it made me feel grateful.
Yeah, I'm grateful too. I'm grateful to be here with you. You were talking about just the idea of tourism starting to come back here. You're clearly seeing that. It's not just a seepage. It's starting to show up.
No, it was starting maybe in June. There was a trickle starting to come in before that, but then it was like we had a who let the dogs out moment. And we had a much busier early summer than usual. And it really maintained itself. And it seems like we're going later into the season. By about the middle of November, it usually is very quiet. But here we are in early December. And later this morning, our two tasting salon rooms, both these intimate settings, will be packed throughout the day.
You have a olive oil bottling today, is that correct?
We do. We have about 200 trees scattered throughout the properties, and we pick the olives, and then we have kind of a friends and co-workers bottling session, and the older the kids, the less messy it gets, and a grilling session, and have lunch, and drink some wine, and it's a big social occasion. And we give the olive oil out as gifts to our members and such.
That's cool. Oh, I like that, because olive oil from Napa Valley is really special.
It is an unfortunate to have on our legacy property, which has been in the family for over 100 years, there are trees planted there that before our ownership of the property. So they're very old trees, and it's a lot of work for a little oil.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
But it's very enjoyable, and it's unfined, unfiltered, and it's the real deal. And I suggest don't cook with it, but use it with your salads and other things at the table.
Like a tasting oil.
It's definitely a tasting oil.
This is an interesting vineyard coming here because you are hiding in plain sight if there was ever anybody doing that. It takes a bit of a challenge to get here to the tasting room only because the road is, it's like the Harry Potter train stop 9.5 or whatever the heck it was. Because there's not a lot of signage. The key is to pay attention to the numbers.
The numbers and the red mailbox. And that's on purpose. And maybe it's just more my style. I'm not the flashiest guy in town. And so we have a red mailbox out on the highway. And when you call to make a reservation, we send you a package of how to get here. It's not the hardest place to find.
No.
It's just off Highway 29. You just have to know when to turn off the road. And then the winery is hidden by a small knoll. So even though you're just off the highway between Yountville and Oakville, you feel like you're in your own little valley. And because we don't have a lot of visitors at any one time, it's intimate one-on-one type stuff. And we like it like that.
Well, what's really neat is when you drive around back here, you are in a different world. You're not, you know, Highway 29 is a very busy place. And many places are very familiar. Then you come back here and your perspective changes. It's really beautiful.
Yes, and it's not unique just to us, but it's also, I think, what makes Napa Valley so interesting. It's all the different folds in geology and geography, which creates all the microclimates. And I've been here my whole life, but you still discover things. You can go deeper in a small place and turn around a hill and you see a familiar landmark, Stag's Leap or Mount St. Helena from a different perspective, or the Yountville Hill. And I think it has something to do with why there is such complexity and difference in wines made from grapes from throughout the valley.
How many acres are you farming here, Tom?
I farm 200, and then for my family, I lease out to another big winery, 600.
Nice. And about how many cases are you making for Gamble?
There's about 3,000 cases for our hospitality members, and then double that amount that we sell out to restaurants and wine shops and such.
Nice. Cool. I had your wine before, and to come here is a really big deal.
Well, I appreciate that.
It's really interesting sitting here talking to you. You're wearing this hoodie that has your name on it. It's good that you can identify yourself. Yeah. 2017, fires, floods, harvest.
Not the funnest year.
Yeah. Well,
but in retrospect, it was better than what's just been going on.
Right. I mean, who would have thought that it was going to get to 2020? My gosh.
Yeah.
Interesting how you can commemorate it. One thing I love about the people of Napa is you wear this proudly, that you guys have dealt with some amazing challenges.
Yes, and the whole world has had a shared calamity to get through. And Napa Valley has faced many calamities throughout its history. And that's just the nature of life. And in 2017, it was not the easiest growing vintage. There was heat spikes and things like that. And of course, we had a fire, but the fire was towards the end of the year, the growing season, versus the 2020 fires that were in the beginning. So in 2017, even though those affected by fire were devastated, the vintage was mostly salvaged and not affected by smoke, whereas in 2020, it happened so early in the vintage, virtually all red grapes received some amount of smoke taint.
Did you harvest at all, or what did you do?
In 2020, we didn't. I have, unfortunately, too much experience with smoke-tainted grapes, and I know it's basically a futile attempt to try to salvage them into high-end wine. That doesn't mean you couldn't make something kind of palatable, but that's not what Gamble does.
Your name's on the label.
And that is why I don't take any risks like that. I'm in agriculture. I take a risk every day with the weather, but my reputation and my name is about all I've got, really, in the end. So,
what actually happens to those grapes? Are they sold off? Do they become some different product? I mean,
It depends. We left a lot of grapes on the vine, and or dropped them to the ground to relieve stress on the vines. And those red grapes that did come in were sold off. And then you sell it to a broker, basically, and then they resell the grapes somewhere.
That's fair. I don't even like to suggest this, but what do you see for the future? Do you think that there is a better plan for fire in California or Napa Valley? Is everybody working harder to try and keep this from being as big of a disaster?
Yeah, a lot of people are reacting after the fact, and there is a lot of work to mitigate it. And I was on my first fire line at 10 years old, and fire is a fact in the West. Not just in California. There's a wonderful book that's densely written called Forgotten Fires, and it really talks about fire and the ecology that we are in. And it looks how the first peoples utilized fire as a tool and how our environment evolved dependent upon fires, not these catastrophic fires, but low-grade fires that happen every so often, I guess you could say. And our fire ecology here is, and what happens is the underbrush gets burned down. The first peoples would do that because it would improve the habitat for the animals.
Sure.
And their textile industry actually depended upon it. The long strands of fresh growth versus woody old growth that they needed to weave their baskets and such. And even the Spanish explorers would talk about having to ride an extra 10 miles to find grass for the horses that night. So fire is nothing new, but in the 1950s, as we became more concerned about the environment, we stopped doing practical things in the name of saving things. We stopped having prescribed burns or having any sort of sustainable yield timbering, which they figured out a long time ago how to do in Europe. So now, because of disaster, and 50 years later, and 50 years of fuel load building, and you need three things for fire: oxygen, fuel, and heat. And that's, I think, what you learn your first day at the fire academy. If you're going to be a firefighter, and you remove one of those and you don't have fire. So we have to get back to manageable fuel loads. And if we don't do it ourselves through some sort of man-made mechanical thing, then nature will get the balance right and in a disastrous way.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. It's always hard to get people to think the way you're talking about it, because politics being what they are. And
it's politics and ingrained thinking about if you touch a brush or something like that, you're desecrating nature. Well, nature, that wasn't what its plan was. And since I grew up with it, I'm fortunate to know what a planned burn looks like. And my father, who is not politically correct, would get on his soapbox and say, in non-PC terms, you're messing with Mother Nature and something bad's going to happen. And something finally has. And so in the east part of Napa, fires are more frequent because of the ecology there. But then it came to the heart of Napa Valley. And there wasn't a lot of motivation after the 2017 fires, but after the 2020 fires, and it was so close to home and many people were devastated. People have woken up in Napa. And now it's a statewide issue as well. So maybe we'll regain some of the wisdom of the first peoples who figured this out over the course of 10,000 years.
It's a great way to put it. Thank you. That was cool. I'm going to say just for a moment, for our listeners hearing a lot of noise in the background, this is a working winery, as many of the wineries we visit are, so you're going to hear some noises from time to time, or bugs being zapped, whatever it might be.
It is. There's a forklift operating out there, getting that olive oil assembly line, bottling line put together.
And the forklift is the coolest part of a winery, in my opinion, because you guys drive those like such experts.
Not me, but the guys do. I'm very rusty.
Oh, yeah, I get that if you don't do it on a regular basis. Well, let's actually take a moment here to talk about the wine, oddly enough. Obviously, predominantly Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yes.
And also Sauvignon Blanc.
Yes.
But what other grapes are you farming in the wine you're making?
We have a good amount of Cabernet Franc, a lesser amount of Merlot, and a lesser amount of Petit Verdot. But we also have in the ground recently... I'm back in the Syrah game, something I love on a very small scale, and Malbec, which is the first time I've planted Malbec.
Really?
Yeah, never have.
That's kind of interesting.
Well,
it grows well around here, to the best of my knowledge.
It does, but the clonal selections that we've had for years made it almost, they weren't great clones available to us, and they were almost alternate bearing, like some fruit and nut trees. And, you know, when you have your farmer hat on, taking a year off from having a crop isn't always something you think you want to do.
Yeah.
But now there's some better clones that have been taken from, I don't know if they're coming from France or Argentina, but they've been studied at UC Davis and they're in the market now. And we're planting some of these more updated clones that don't have that issue.
When do you think you'll have your first vintage?
Well, I got planted, the Malbec got planted this year, so we're... back in 6 years and we might have a bottle for you.
Yeah, once again, that's that whole concept of farming and being a winemaker is that there is no immediate result. You have to wait.
It is. You've got to be patient in this game, and your economic reward is out there somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere. As a winemaker, you've been doing this for a while. What's the strangest advice you've ever gotten?
The strangest advice I've ever gotten. Because I've been thinking about this a lot. It may not be, it's definitely up there, but it plant this really weak rootstock and grow a weak vine. And that was an advice that a lot of people took in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s. And the concept behind that is you want the vine to struggle. And so you plant a debilitating rootstock that makes the vine struggle. Well, the problem with that is they're not drought tolerant. You have to use more water to keep the vine going. We found that some of those vines are even more susceptible. We don't have winters like you do, but in a cold winter, it can harm the vine too because it hasn't stored sufficient carbohydrates to weather through the winter. And so, and I've always been of the opinion, give me a healthy vine and then I can figure out a way to create the stress I want and the competition it needs to produce quality grapes. I think some of the thinking is coming back around to my way. I was definitely considered by some kind of an idiot for going down that path. But we're in a drought, but my vines are surviving just fine. And I'm always experimenting with different rootstocks, and I don't have 100% batting average, but I've got better than most. When the experiment goes awry, you start over. But you can't keep moving forward in your knowledge unless you do try other things.
And you got to make mistakes.
Yeah, you're going to make mistakes. But I guess I use the metaphor of going to the Super Bowl. Give me a strong, healthy athlete, and as the coach, I know how to stress them. And if you overstress them, they're going to hurt themselves and not make it to the Super Bowl. But if you don't put enough stress on them, they're not going to make it to the Super Bowl either.
Yeah, they get lazy.
So it's a fine balance. And, you know, I've been, doing this for 40 years on the viticulture side. So I've learned something.
You know a couple of things.
Yeah, usually more from doing the wrong things than from book learning, but plenty of book learning too.
That's an interesting point. I like to refer to winemakers as being mad scientists because you guys do experiment, you do things to learn. Maybe occasionally you just get a little bit of a wild hair like, what do I do this? Have you done that? Obviously the property is very valuable. There's only so much experimentation you could do that'd be reasonable. But are there any kind of grapes you tried to grow that would have been that?
Well, I mentioned some of the grapes, but there's two things I'm experimenting with that are real wild cards. One is, you've probably heard of Pierce disease and discussed that with other people. And what that is it's a bacteria that has a really long scientific name, so I won't try to pronounce it. But it's a bacteria that lives in the fluids of plants, not just grapevines. And host plants don't get sick from it. And then you have bugs. And a success story in Napa is we have a lot more bugs than we used to because we don't spray harsh chemicals. But if the bug, and these particular bugs are called sharpshooters because they have a very sharp needle nose, And they'll go and stick that nose into a plant along the river or in the forest or in the garden. And Pierce disease really likes non-native plants. And then the sharpshooter flies over to the vine and then transmits that to the disease to the vine, so it's and where it's lethal. So UC Davis has been working on this project to curtail Pierce disease. And if you've heard of the glassy wing sharpshooter, that's the big boy that we work hard to keep out, but we still have its little cousin, the blue-green sharpshooter.
Oh, geez.
And so they're native to the area. And you don't want to nuke them and kill them using insecticides because that just sterilizes the earth. So you're always trying to get the balance right of having good bugs eating the quote-unquote bad bugs. And so it's farming by Henry Kissinger, I say. It's détente. You're balancing the forces of good and evil. But getting back to UC Davis, they have been on a plant breeding program for a very long time, more than 20 years. It's closing 30. And Professor Andrew Walker, a really interesting guy, he has been leading this. It's been his career since he got his PhD, breeding these plants. And what he's been breeding is North American varieties with Vitis vinifera. Vitis vinifera is the family of grapes from Europe that makes all the yummy wines that we really like. And we don't so much like the wines made from grapes in North America for the most part. There are some good exceptions, particularly in the Northeast, that I think are getting better. But so he found this one North American vine called Vitis arizonicus. And so it's from the southwest of Mexico. And he crossbred that many times with different Vitis vinifera cultivars. So it's the end result after 30 years is a plant that is 97% Vitis vinifera and 3% North American variety. Hmm. But it's resistant to Pierce disease.
Wow.
And I have planted a little bit in a Pierce-heavy area that is related to Sauvignon Blanc. And Sauvignon Blanc is my white wine of passion. And so we're early days. Plants are growing well. Don't have enough grapes yet to really make a test lot. But we've tasted the grapes and made little five-gallon experiments. And it's going to be an interesting result. Will it be a standalone variety? You were asking about other mad scientist things we do. We have a whole program that I give to my winemaker, Jim Kloss, called Just This Once. And so he gets to go and fool around and put together weird blends or a single block of a vineyard we've never tried before. And we make 70 to 100 cases, and it always sells out to our membership. So GambleFamilyVineyards.com, join the membership, and you too might be able to get yourself a bottle. And that always sells out in a few days. So that's one thing we're doing. So you plant these plants along Pierce-infected areas, and then your vines don't die. So I'm treading lightly, but I could see myself planting more. And there are white varieties they have developed, and there are red varieties. The other kind of crazy thing I'm doing is, and this is really whacked, but it's Sauvignon Blanc related again. Sauvignon Blanc did not just come over the Atlantic to North America. It somehow traveled eastward to Asia. I don't know, on the Silk Road or Marco Polo times. I really don't know. But it ended up in China. And it probably inadvertently crossed with Vitis Davidi, David with two eyes at the end, which is an Asian native grapevine species. And it's called Koshu. And somehow, after crossing probably in mainland China, it somehow got to the Koshu prefecture of Japan hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And it's a pink grape that makes this very elegantly perfumed wine with a body density that goes really well with traditional rice-based and fish dishes that are traditional in Japan. And it's very hard to find the good stuff here in the States because all the good stuff gets consumed and you get some pretty weak representations over here. And I knew nothing about this, and I was flipping through my Janice Robinson encyclopedia. This is interesting. And I sell about 20 cases of wine to Japan a year. And my Japanese importer said, hey, have you ever thought about planting this? I said, no. Would you? It'd be fun to get some growers together and, and try to do it. So I've got about a quarter acre of it planted. And still early days, but they're tough skin grapes, probably chosen because it's a high humidity climate where they're in Japan. And so tough skin grapes ward off mold and mildew better. And I'm trellising it, not like they do there, which is in a pergola style, but as I would my other grapes. So early days on that still.
I'd look forward to trying that. I think the fascinating thing about something like this, though, is there has to be change in the wine industry just because of nature, because of maybe it's climate change, maybe it's a number of things. And Napa Valley is one place that needs to move along with that. I think it's a cool idea.
It is. Cabernet is actually just a modern phenomenon in Napa Valley. Up Valley, say north of St. Helena, towards Calistoga, there wasn't a whole bunch of Cabernet Sauvignon planted up there. It was more planted to Zinfandels and Syrahs, Petit Syrahs, Charbonneaux and such. And it's only because there are good and bad things in California for having chosen to go the varietal designation route versus, say, in Bordeaux, where their blends and you just know them by their house names, their chateau names. But I think Cabernet Sauvignon will remain king for a very long time, but there's lots of room for little princes and princesses as well. And I also think that the youngest wine drinkers, every wine drinking generation since World War II has become more and more adventurous, and add food to that as well. And I think that they're willing to try things other than their mom and father's Cabernet Sauvignon.
Totally agree. We're seeing a lot of that, I think, right now. A lot of history here in Napa Valley, certainly a great deal, but being very apparent after Prohibition. But for you, with 40 years in this part of the business, with the viticulture behind you, let alone your own life, who's been your mentor or mentors that have really influenced you?
Yeah, Jack Davies, who had Schramsberg. I grew up with his kids and their close family friends. He gave me some early advice and some attaboys. Joe Phelps picked me up when I was down in the dumps early in my on the winemaking side of the career. Listened to sob stories at the bar and said, you're doing everything you need to be doing, just keep doing it. Louis Martini had some very good advice for me. I was a very young man. I asked why. It may have influenced how I buy vineyards when the bank gives me money to feed my habit. It's a 12-step program, but I refuse to take the first step and admit I have a problem.
Yeah, sure.
I asked him why he had vineyards from, and I was in my 20s when I asked him, he had vineyards from Carneros all the way up to Calistoga. And he says, sometimes it's too hot in Calistoga and sometimes it's too cold in Carneros. And you have vineyards in all these places and you end up with a good wine every year.
You're hedging your bets.
Hedging bets. And he had lots of different varieties too. So those are some of the real old timers, I would say. And all those guys were really in the vanguard after Prohibition and World War II.
Sure. Do you ever think you'd write a book?
No, I haven't. You know, maybe one day when I'm trying to not work in the business every day, but that's a transition.
Yeah.
And to succeed and be a sustainable family-run business, you have to learn how to work on the business versus in it and bring along another generation. And, you know, I do owe the banks money, so they won't let me ever die.
Sure. Yeah.
But just in case,
yeah.
I am trying to do that. But I haven't ever written a book. I mean, Robin Lale, who is another big inspiration on the family business side, she's been writing a book forever, but she's also still out there selling wine at 81 years old, and she's a dynamo.
She's amazing.
What is interesting about this business is, I guess it is passion, because people don't retire in their 60s. They just keep going. I mean, Mr. Mondavi was, he was full tilt well into his 80s.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, a winemaker in Finger Lakes said this to me one day, just a general statement. She goes, you don't really often meet former winemakers, other than owing the bank money, which is part of that, I guess.
Yeah, it was kind of a joke, but it's a passion. There are much easier ways to make money than to be in this business. And I stand on broad shoulders, and I try to respect our past, make the changes that are necessary to continue on as a family business. And I've added the wine side. We're always farmers. I've added the wine side, and there are nieces and nephews now getting to the age of getting through college and having their first jobs. And they've worked here in the summertime and all that. And now they're out exploring what the world has to offer. And that's a great experience. And you know, another half decade, perhaps some of them will be coming back.
Yeah, I hope so. I always have to ask my favorite question. And I don't think I posed this to you last time, but I will anyway. For the time you've done media, and I'm sure you've done plenty of it, what's the one question you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Oh, my God. Never thought about that. I've been asked, but I don't think it's been in an interview. And, you know, what would you farm if it wasn't grapes?
And, that's a good question.
And in Napa Valley, I don't know if you could farm anything economically.
Yeah, the property is just a little expensive.
And while there are dollars in cannabis, it's a resource-intensive crop. It uses 5 times more water per acre on an outdoor grow than vines do. So that would be out. I'm kind of like my grandfather. I don't know that I would raise livestock to make money, but we do have some animals that we use for vegetation management, and I love hanging out with them. It's peaceful.
I bet it is. I just had this great image of the old coyote, Roadrunner coyote, where they clocked in and clocked out.
Oh, yeah, and they had Sam the sheepdog.
They said the sheepdog, yeah. Well,
we have some massive guardian dogs that my ranch manager has to protect the calves and such from coyotes and the mountain lions. And we now had a wolf come down from Oregon and make it all the way down to San Luis Obispo.
Crazy.
And it's a fascinating story about this lone wolf. And there hadn't been a wolf that far south in California since the 1920s. So young wolves will go out and explore new territories. And he covered over 1,000 miles in a relatively short amount of time. And he crisscrossed I-5 several times, Interstate 5, and he was on a side road and he got hit.
Oh, man, that's a shame in a way.
It is. But wolves are coming, and so we have dogs that are able to defend against wolves and love people.
That's good. Dogs are fun anyway. It's a winery. You got to have a winery dog.
They are. I love the land, and that's why I do this, I think. And wine is just a wonderful way to express your love of land.
And people like me are very grateful. Tom, for our listeners, I'm sure they'd like to learn a little bit more about you. What is your web address?
It's gamblefamilyvineyards.com.
Is there any other way you'd like people to contact you, email or otherwise?
Yes, wine@gamblefamilyvineyards.com if you're interested in purchasing something. And again, gamblefamilyvineyards.com is the website. And you can see some of our wines. We have wines for the public available, but there's many wines that are reserved just for our members.
Excellent. And for tastings, it's by appointment, as you said. Somebody can call up. They do that through the website. How they do that?
That email, wine@gamblefamilyvineyards.com. One of my lovely private client managers will get back to you and set up a time and give you suggestions on other wineries to visit to, or restaurants or hotels or whatever you need. And we do ask that you be vaccinated when you come on the property.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you for your time. It's good to see you after such a long time.
It's good to be seen.
Yeah. I mean, well, feeling that
other things could have happened.
Yeah. Well, thank God they didn't. But I appreciate you taking the time for us today.
Thank you.
Learn more by visiting gamblefamilyvineyards.com. Thanks for listening to the longest-running wine podcast online. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Pascoff. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Our intern is Clement Maddox. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.